Carol was already at Holyoke when I got there. She had brought a couple of milk boxes from the area where the dumpsters were lined up and was sitting on one of them, legs crossed, smoking a cigarette. I sat down on the other one, put my arm around her, and kissed her. She put her head on my shoulder for a moment, not saying anything. This wasn't much like her, but it was nice. I kept my arm around her and looked up at the stars. The night was mild for so late in the season, and lots of people, couples mostly, were out walking, taking advantage of the weather. I could hear their murmured conversations. From above us, in the Commons dining room, a radio was playing Hang On Sloopy, one of the janitors, I suppose. Carol raised her head at last and moved away from me a little, just enough to let me know I could take my arm back. That was more like her, actually. "Thanks," she said. "I needed a hug." "My pleasure. I'm a little scared about facing my dad. Not real scared, but a little. It'll be all right. Not saying it because I really thought it would be. I couldn't know a thing like that. But because it's what you say, isn't it? Just what you say. My dad's not the reason I went with Harry and George and the rest. It's no big Freudian rebellion or anything like that." She flicked her cigarette away, and we watched it fountain sparks when it struck the bricks of Bennett's Walk. Then she took her little clutch purse out of her lap, opened it, found her wallet, opened that, and thumbed through a selection of snapshots stuck in those small celluloid windows. She stopped, slipped one out, and handed it to me. I leaned forward so I could see it by the light falling through the dining hall windows, where the janitors were probably doing the floors. The picture showed three kids of 11 or 12, a girl and two boys. They were all wearing blue T-shirts with the words Sterling House on them in red block letters. They were standing in a parking lot somewhere and had their arms around each other, an easy pals forever pose that was sort of beautiful. The girl was in the middle. The girl was Carol, of course. "Which one is Sully John?" I asked. She looked at me a little surprised, but with a smile. In any case, I thought, I already knew. Sully John would be the one with the broad shoulders, the wide grin, and the tumbled black hair. It reminded me of Stokes' hair, although the boy had obviously run a comb through his thatch. I tapped him. "This one, right?" "That's Sully," she agreed, then touched the face of the other boy with her fingernail. He had a sunburn rather than a tan. His face was narrower, the eyes a little closer together, the hair a carroty red and mowed in a crew cut that made him look like a kid on a Norman Rockwell Saturday Evening Post cover. There was a faint frown line on his brow. Sully's arms were already muscular for a kid's. This other boy had thin arms, thin stick arms. They were probably still thin stick arms. On the hand not slung around Carol's shoulders, he was wearing a big brown baseball glove. "This one's Bobby," she said. Her voice had changed somehow. There was something in it I'd never heard before. Sorrow. But she was still smiling. If it was sorrow, she felt, why was she smiling? "Bobby Garfield. He was my first boyfriend, my first love, I guess you could say. He and Sully and I were best friends back then. Not so long ago, 1960, but it seems long ago." "What happened to him?" I was somehow sure she was going to tell me he had died, this boy with the narrow face and the crew-cut carrot top. "He and his mom moved away. We wrote back and forth for a while, and then we lost touch. You know how kids are. Nice baseball glove." Carol, still with the smile. I could see the tears that had come into her eyes as we sat looking down at the snapshot, but still with the smile. In the white light of the fluorescence from the dining hall, her tears looked silver, the tears of a princess in a fairy tale. That was Bobby's favorite thing. There's a baseball player named Alvin Dark, right? There was. That's what kind of a glove Bobby had, an Alvin Dark model. Mine was a Ted Williams. I think my mom rummage-sailed it a couple of years ago. "Bobby's got stolen," Carol said. I'm not sure she knew I was there anymore. She kept touching that narrow, slightly frowning face with her fingertip. It was as if she had regressed into her own past. I've heard that hypnotists can do that with good subjects. Willie took it. Willie? Willie Shearman. I saw him playing ball with it a year later, down at Sterling House. I was so mad. My mom and dad were always fighting then, working up to the divorce, I guess, and I was mad all the time, mad at them, mad at my math teacher, mad at the whole world. I was still scared of Willie, but mostly I was mad at him, and besides, I wasn't by myself, not that day. So I marched right up to him, and I said I knew that was Bobby's glove, and he ought to give it to me. I said I had Bobby's address in Massachusetts, and I'd send it to him. Willie said I was crazy. It was his glove, and he showed me his name on the side. He'd erased Bobby's, best as he could, anyway, and printed his own over where it had been, but I could still see the BBY from Bobby. A creepy sort of indignation had crept into her voice. It made her sound younger, and look younger. I suppose my memory could be wrong about that, but I don't think it is. Sitting there on the edge of the white light from the dining hall, I think she looked about 12, 13 at the most. He couldn't erase the Alvin Dark signature in the pocket, though, or right over it. And he blushed. Dark red, red as roses. Then, do you know what? He apologized for what he and his two friends did to me. He was the only one who ever did, and I think he meant it. But he lied about the glove. I don't think he wanted it. It was old, and the webbing was all broken out, and it looked all wrong on his hand. But he lied so he could keep it. I don't understand why. I never have. I'm not following this, I said. Why should you? It's all jumbled up in my mind, and I was there. My mother told me once that happens to people who are in accidents or fights. I remember some of it pretty well, mostly the parts with Bobby in them. But almost everything else comes from what people told me later on. I was in the park, down the street from my house, and these three boys came along. Harry Doolin, Willie Shearman, and another one. I can't remember the other one's name. It doesn't matter anyway. They beat me up. I was only 11, but that didn't stop them. Harry Doolin hit me with a baseball bat. Willie and the other one held me so I couldn't run away. A baseball bat? Are you shitting me? She shook her head. At first they were joking, I think, and then they weren't. My arm got dislocated. I screamed, and I guess they ran away. I sat there holding my arm, too hurt and too shocked, I guess, to know what to do. Or maybe I tried to get up and get help for myself and couldn't. Then Bobby came along. He walked me out of the park, and then he picked me up and he carried me back to his apartment. All the way up Broad Street Hill, on one of the hottest days of the year, he carried me in his arms. I took the snapshot from her, held it in the light, and bent over it, looking at the boy with the crew cut, looking at his thin stick arms, then looking at the girl. She was an inch or two taller than he was, and broader in the shoulders. I looked at the other boy, Sully, he of the tumbled black hair and the all-American grin, Stoke Jones's hair, Skip Kirk's grin. I could see Sully carrying her in his arms. Yeah, but the other kid. I know, she said. He doesn't look big enough, does he? But he carried me. I started to faint, and he carried me. She took the picture back. And while he was doing that, this kid Willie, who helped beat you up, came back and stole his glove? She nodded. Bobby took me to his apartment. There was this old guy who lived in a room upstairs, Ted, who seemed to know a little bit about everything. He popped my arm back into its socket. I remember he gave me his belt to bite on when he did it, or maybe it was Bobby's belt. He said I could catch the pain, and I did. After that, something bad happened. Worse than getting lumped up with a baseball bat? In a way. I don't want to talk about it. She wiped her tears away with one hand, first one side and then the other, still looking at the snapshot. Later on, before he and his mother left Harwich, Bobby beat up the boy who actually used the bat, Harry Doolin. Carol put her photograph back in its little compartment. What I remember best about that day, the only thing about it worth remembering, is that Bobby Garfield stood up for me. Sully was bigger, and Sully might have stood up for me if he'd been there, but he wasn't. Bobby was there, and he carried me all the way up the hill. He did what was right. It's the best thing, the most important thing, anyone has ever done for me in my life. Do you see that, Pete? Yeah, I do. I saw something else, too. She was saying almost exactly what Nate had said not an hour before, only she had marched, had taken one of the signs and marched with it. Of course, Nate Hoppenstand had never been beaten up by three boys who started out joking and then decided they were serious, and maybe that was the difference. "He carried me up that hill," she said. "I always wanted to tell him how much I loved him for that, and how much I loved him for showing Harry Doolin that there's a price to pay for hurting people, especially people who are smaller than you and don't mean you any harm." "So you marched?" "I marched. I wanted to tell someone why. I wanted to tell someone who'd understand. My father won't, and my mother can't. Her friend Rionda called me and said..." She didn't finish, only sat there on the milk box, fidgeting with her little bag. "Said what?" "Nothing." She sounded exhausted, forlorn. I wanted to kiss her, at least put my arm around her, but I was afraid doing either would spoil what had just happened. Because something had happened. There was magic in her story. Not in the middle, but somewhere out around the edges. I felt it. I marched, and I guess I'll join the Committee of Resistance. My roommate says I'm crazy. I'll never get a job if a commie student group's part of my college records, but I think I'm going to do it. And your father? What about him? Fuck him. There was a semi-shocked moment when we considered what she had just said, and then Carol giggled. Now that's Freudian. She stood up. I have to go back and study. Thanks for coming out, Pete. I haven't ever shown that picture to anyone. I haven't looked at it myself in who knows how long. I feel better. Lots. Good. I got up myself. Before you go in, will you help me do something? Sure, what? I'll show you. It won't take long. I walked her down the side of Holyoke, and then we started up the hill behind it. About 200 yards away was the steam plant parking lot, where undergrads ineligible for parking stickers, freshmen, sophomores, and most juniors, had to keep their cars. It was the prime makeout spot on campus once it got cold, but making out in my car wasn't on my mind that night. "Did you ever tell Bobby about who got his baseball glove?" I asked. "You said you wrote to him." "I didn't see the point." We walked in silence for a little while. Then I said, "I'm going to call it off with Anne-Marie over Thanksgiving." I started to phone her, then didn't. If I'm going to do it, I guess I better find the guts to do it face to face. I hadn't been aware of coming to any such decision, not consciously, but it seemed I had. Certainly it wasn't something I was saying just to please Carol. She nodded, scuffing through the leaves in her sneakers, holding her little bag in one hand, not looking at me. I had to use the phone, called S.J. and told him I was seeing a guy. I stopped. "When?" "Last week." Now she looked up at me, dimples, slightly curved lower lip, the smile. "Last week? And you didn't tell me?" "It was my business," she said, "mine and Sully's. I mean, it isn't like he's going to come after you with a..." She paused long enough for both of us to think, "with a baseball bat," and then went on, "that he's going to come after you or anything. Come on, Pete. If we're going to do something, let's do it. I'm not going riding with you, though. I really have to study." "No rides." We got walking again. The steam plant lot seemed huge to me in those days. Hundreds of cars parked in dozens of moonlit rows. I could hardly ever remember where I left my brother's old Ford wagon. The last time I was back at UM, the lot was 3, maybe even 4 times as big, with space for 1,000 cars or more. Time passes and everything gets bigger except us. Hey, Pete? Walking. Looking down at her sneakers again, even though we were on asphalt now and there were no more leaves to scuff. Uh-huh. I don't want you to go breaking up with Anne-Marie because of me. Because I have an idea where... temporary. All right? Yeah. What she said made me unhappy. It was what the citizens of Atlantis referred to as a bummer, but it didn't really surprise me. I guess it'll have to be. I like you, and I like being with you now, but it's just liking you, that's all it is, and it's best to be honest. So if you want to keep your mouth shut when you go home for the holiday, kind of keep her around at home, sort of like a spare tire in case we get a flat here at school. She looked startled, then laughed. Touché, she said. Touché for what? I don't even know, Pete, but I do like you. She stopped, turned to me, slipped her arms around my neck. We kissed for a little while between the two rows of cars, kissed until I got a pretty decent bone on, one I'm sure she could feel. Then she gave me a final peck on the lips, and we started walking again. What did Sully say when you told him? I don't know if I'm supposed to ask, but you want information, she said in a brusque number two voice. Then she laughed. It was the rueful one. I was expecting he'd be angry, or that he might even cry. Sully's big, and he scares the devil out of the football players he matches up against, but his feelings are always close to the skin. What I didn't expect was relief. Relief? Relief. He's been seeing this girl in Bridgeport for a month or more, except my mom's friend Rhonda told me she's actually a woman, maybe 24 or 25. Sounds like a recipe for disaster, I said, hoping I sounded measured and thoughtful. I was actually delighted. Of course I was. And if poor old gosh-darned tender-hearted John Sullivan stumbled into the plot of a country-western Merle Haggard song, well, 400 million red Chinese wouldn't give a shit, and that went double for me. We had almost arrived at my car. It was just one more old heap among all the others, but, courtesy of my brother, it was mine. He's got more on his mind than his new love interest, Carol said. He's going into the Army when he finishes high school next June. He's already talked to the recruiter and got it arranged. He can't wait to get over there in Vietnam and start making the world safe for democracy. Did you have a fight with him about the war? Nope. What would be the use? For that matter, what would I tell him? That for me it's all about Bobby Garfield? That all the stuff Harry Swiderowski and George Gilman and Hunter McPhail say seems like smoke and mirrors compared to Bobby carrying me up Broad Street Hill? Sully would think I was crazy. Or say it's because I'm too smart. Sully feels sorry for people who are too smart. He says being too smart is a disease. And maybe he's right. I kind of love him, you know. He's sweet. He's also the kind of guy who needs someone to take care of him. And I hope he finds someone, I thought, just as long as it's not you. She looked judiciously at my car. Okay, she said. It's ugly. It desperately needs a wash, but it's transportation. The question is, what are we doing here when I should be reading a Flannery O'Connor story? I took out my pocket knife and opened it. Got a nail file in your bag? As a matter of fact, I do. Are we going to fight? Number two and number six go at it in the steam plant parking lot? Don't be a smartass. Just get it out and follow me. By the time we got around to the back of the station wagon, she was laughing. Not the rueful laugh, but the full-out guffaw I'd first heard when Skip's horny hot dog man came down the dishline conveyor belt. She finally understood why we were here. Carol took one side of the bumper sticker. I took the other. We met in the middle. Then we watched the shreds blow away across the macadam. Au revoir, AUH2O for USA. Bye-bye, Barry. And we laughed. Man, we just couldn't stop laughing. A couple of days later, my friend Skip, who'd come to college with the political awareness of a mollusk, put up a poster on his side of the room he shared with Brad Witherspoon. It showed a smiling businessman in a three-piece suit. One hand was extended to shake. The other was hidden behind his back, but something clutched in it was dripping blood between his shoes. "War is good business," the poster said. "Invest your son." Deary was horrified. "So you're against Vietnam now?" he asked when he saw it. Below his chin-out truculence, I think our beloved floor proctor was badly shocked by that poster. Skip, after all, had been a first-class high school baseball player, was expected to play college ball, too, had been courted by both Delta Tau Delta and Phi Gam, the jock frats. Skip was no sickly cripple like Stoke Jones. Deary Dearborn had also taken to calling Stoke Rip-Rip. No frog-eyed weirdo like George Gilman. "Hey, all this poster means is that a lot of people are making money out of a big bloody mess," Skip said. "McDonnell Douglas, Boeing, GE, Dow Chemical and Coleman Chemicals, Pepsi fucking Cola, lots more." Deary's gimlet gaze conveyed, or tried to, the idea that he had thought about such issues more deeply than Skip Kirk ever could. "Let me ask you something. Do you think we should just stand back and let Uncle Ho take over down there?" "I don't know what I think," Skip said. "Not yet. I only started getting interested in the subject a couple of weeks ago. I'm still playing catch-up." This was at 7:30 in the morning, and a little group outbound for 8 o'clock classes had gathered around Skip's door. I saw Ronnie, plus Nick Prouty. By this point, the two of them had become inseparable. Ashley Rice, Lenny Doria, Billy Marchant, maybe four or five others. Nate was leaning in the doorway of 302, wearing a T-shirt and his PJ bottoms. In the stairwell, Stoke Jones leaned on his crutches. He had apparently been on his way out and had turned back to monitor the discussion. Deary said, "When the Viet Cong come into a South Viet Ville, the first thing they look for are people wearing crucifixes, St. Christopher medals, Mary medals, anything of that nature. Catholics are killed. People who believe in God are killed. Do you think we should stand back while the commies kill people who believe in God?" "Why not?" Stoke said from the stairwell. "We stood back and let the Nazis kill the Jews for 6 years. Jews believe in God, or so I'm told." "Fucking Rip-Rip," Ronnie shouted. "Who the fuck asked you to play the piano?" But by then, Stoke Jones, a.k.a. Rip-Rip, was making his way down the stairs. The echoey sound of his crutches made me think of the recently departed Frank Stewart. Deary turned back to Skip. His hands were fisted on his hips. Lying against the front of his white T-shirt was a set of dog tags. His father had worn them in France and Germany, he told us, had been wearing them as he lay behind a tree, hiding from the machine gun fire that had killed 2 men in his company and wounded 4 more. What this had to do with the Vietnam conflict, none of us quite knew, but it was clearly a big deal to Deary, so none of us asked. Even Ronnie had sense enough to keep his trap shut. "If we let them take South Vietnam, they'll take Cambodia." Deary's eyes moved from Skip to me to Ronnie to all of us. "Then Laos, then the Philippines, one after the other." "If they can do that, maybe they deserve to win," I said. Deary looked at me, shocked. I was sort of shocked myself, but I didn't take it back. There was one more round of prelims before the Thanksgiving break, and for the young scholars of Chamberlain III, it was a disaster. By then, most of us understood that we were a disaster, that we were committing a kind of group suicide. Kirby McClendon did his freak-out thing and disappeared like a rabbit in a magic trick. Kenny Auster, who usually sat in the corner during the marathon games and picked his nose when he couldn't decide what card to play next, simply bugged out one day. He left a queen of spades with the words, "I quit," written across it on his pillow. George Lessard joined Steve Ogg and Jack Frady in Chad, the brain dorm. 6 down, 13 to go. It should have been enough. Hell, just what happened to poor old Kirby should have been enough. In the last 3 or 4 days before he freaked, his hands were trembling so badly he had trouble picking up his cards, and he jumped in his seat if someone slammed a door in the hall. Kirby should have been enough, but he wasn't. Nor was my time with Carol the answer. When I was actually with her, yes, I was fine. When I was with her, all I wanted was information, and maybe to bawl her socks off. When I was in the dorm, though, especially in that goddamn third-floor lounge, I became another version of Peter Riley. In the third-floor lounge, I was a stranger to myself. As Thanksgiving approached, a kind of blind fatalism set in. None of us talked about it, though. We talked about the movies, or sex. "I get more ass than a merry-go-round pony," Ronnie used to crow, usually with no warning or conversational lead-in of any kind. But mostly we talked about Vietnam and hearts. Our hearts discussions were about who was ahead, who was behind, and who couldn't seem to master the few simple strategic ploys of the game. Void yourself in at least one suit. Pass mid-range hearts to someone who likes to shoot the moon. If you have to take a trick, always take it high. Our only real response to the looming third round of prelims was to organize the game into a kind of endless revolving tournament. We were still playing Nicola Point, but we were now also playing for match points. The system for awarding match points was quite complex, but Randy Eccles and Hugh Brennan worked out a good formula in 2 feverish late-night sessions. Both of them, incidentally, were flunking their introductory math courses. Neither was invited back at the conclusion of the fall semester. 33 years have passed since that pre-Thanksgiving round of exams, and the man that boy became still winces at the memory of them. I flunked everything but sociology and intro English. I didn't have to see the grades to know it, either. Skip said he'd flag the board except for calc, and there he barely squeaked by. I was taking Carol out to a movie that night, our one pre-break date, and our last, although I didn't know that then, and saw Ronnie Malenfant on my way to get my car. I asked him how he thought he'd done on his tests. Ronnie smiled and winked and said, "Aced everything, champ, just like on fucking College Bowl. I'm not worried." But in the light of the parking lot, I could see his smile wavering minutely at the corners. His skin was too pale, and his acne, bad when we started school in September, was worse than ever. "How about you?" "They're going to make me Dean of Arts and Sciences," I said. "That tell you anything?" Ronnie burst out laughing. "You fucking pisspot!" He clapped me on the shoulder. The cocky look in his eyes had been replaced by fright that made him look younger. "Going out?" "Yeah." "Carol?" "Yeah." "Good for you. She's a great-looking chick." For Ronnie, this was nearly heart-rending sincerity. "And if I don't see you in the lounge later on, have a great turkey day." "You too, Ronnie." "Yeah, sure." Looking at me from the corners of his eyes rather than straight on, trying to hold the smile. "One way or another, I guess we're both going to eat the bird, wouldn't you say?" "Yeah, I guess that pretty well sums it up." It was hot. Even with the engine off and the heater off, it was hot. We had warmed up the whole inside of the car with our bodies. The windows steamed so that the light from the parking lot came in all diffused, like light through a pebbled glass bathroom window, and the radio was on. Mighty John Marshall making with the oldies, the humble yet nonetheless mighty, playing the Four Seasons and the Dovells, and Jack Scott and Little Richard and Freddie Boom Boom Cannon, all those oldies. And her sweater was open, and her bra was draped over the seat with one strap hanging down, a thick white strap. Bra technology in those days hadn't yet taken that next great leap forward. And, oh man, her skin was warm, her nipple rough in my mouth, and she still had her panties on, but only sort of. They were all pushed and bunched to one side, and I had first one finger in her, and then 2 fingers, Chuck Berry singing Johnny B. Goode and the Royal Teens singing Short Shorts, and her hand was inside my fly, fingers pulling at the elastic of my own short shorts, and I could smell her, the perfume on her neck and the sweat on her temples just below where her hair started, and I could hear her, hear the live pulse of her breath, wordless whispers in my mouth as we kissed, All of this, with the front seat of my car pushed back as far as it would go, me not thinking of flunked prelims or the war in Vietnam or LBJ wearing a lei or hearts or anything, only wanting her. Wanting her right here and right now. And then, suddenly, she was straightening up and straightening me up, both hands planted on my chest, splayed fingers pushing me back toward the steering wheel. I moved toward her again, slipping one of my own hands up her thigh, and she said, "Pete, no," in a sharp voice, and closed her legs, the knees coming together loud enough so I could hear the sound they made, that locking sound that means you're done making out, like it or not. I didn't like it, but I stopped. I leaned my head back against the fogged-up window on the driver's side, breathing hard. My cock was an iron bar stuffed down the front of my underwear, so hard it hurt. That would go away soon enough. No hard-on lasts forever. I think Benjamin Disraeli said that. But even after the erection's gone, the blue balls linger on. It's just a fact of guy life. We had left the movie, some really terrible good old boy thing with Burt Reynolds in it, early, and had come back to the steam plant parking lot with the same thing on our minds. Or so I'd hoped. I guess it was the same thing, except I had been hoping for a little more of it than I'd gotten. Carol had pulled the sides of her sweater together, but her bra still hung over the back of the seat, and she looked madly desirable, with her breasts trying to tumble out through the gap and half an aureola visible in the dim light. She had her purse open and was fumbling her cigarettes out with shaky hands. "Whew," she said. Her voice was as shaky as her hands. "I mean, holy cow." "You look like Brigitte Bardot with your sweater open like that," I told her. She looked up, surprised and, I thought, pleased. "Do you really think so, or is it just the blonde hair?" "The hair? Shit, no. Mostly it's..." I gestured toward her front. She looked down at herself and laughed. She didn't do the buttons, though, or try to pull the sides any more closely together. I'm not sure she could have, anyway. As I remember, that sweater was a wonderfully tight fit. There was a theater up the street from us when I was a kid, the Asher Empire. It's torn down now, but when we were kids, Bobby and Sully John and me, it seemed they were always showing her pictures. I think that one of them, And God Created Woman, must have played there for about 1,000 years. I burst out laughing and took my own cigarettes off the dashboard. That was always the third feature at the Gates Falls drive-in on Friday and Saturday nights. Did you ever see it? Are you kidding? I wasn't even allowed to go to the drive-in unless it was a Disney double feature. I think I must have seen Tonka with Sal Mineo at least 7 times. But I remember the previews. Bridget and her towel. "I'm not coming back to school," she said, and lit her cigarette. She spoke so calmly that at first I thought we were still talking about old movies, or Midnight in Calcutta, or whatever it took to persuade our bodies that it was time to go back to sleep, the action was over. Then it clicked in my head. I said I'm not coming back after break, and it's not going to be much of a Thanksgiving at home as far as that goes, but what the hell? Your father? She shook her head, drawing on her cigarette. In the light of its coal, her face was all orange highlights and crescents of gray shadow. She looked older, still beautiful, but older. On the radio, Paul Anka was singing Diana. I snapped it off. My father's got nothing to do with it. I'm going back to Harwich. Do you remember me mentioning my mother's friend, Rhonda? I sort of did, so I nodded. Rhonda took the picture I showed you, the one of me with Bobby and S.J. She says... Carol looked down at her skirt, which was still hiked most of the way to her waist, and began plucking at it. You can never tell what's going to embarrass people. Sometimes it's toilet functions. Sometimes it's the sexual hijinks of relatives. Sometimes it's show-off behavior. And sometimes, of course, it's drink. Let's put it this way. My dad's not the only one in the Gerber family with a booze problem. He taught my mother how to tip her elbow, and she was a good student. For a long time, she laid off. She went to AA meetings, I think. But Rhonda says she started again, so I'm going home. I don't know if I can take care of her or not, but I'm going to try. For my brother as much as my mother. Rionda says Ian doesn't know if he's coming or going. Of course, he never did. She smiled. Carol, that's maybe not such a good idea, to shoot your education that way. She looked up angrily. You want to talk about shooting my education? You know what I'm hearing about that fucking hearts game on Chamberlain 3 these days? That everyone on the floor is going to flunk out by Christmas, including you. Penny Lang says that by the start of spring semester there won't be anyone left up there but that shithead Proctor of yours. Nah, I said. That's an exaggeration. Nate'll be left. Stokely Jones, too, if he doesn't break his neck going downstairs some night. You act as though it's funny, she said. It's not funny, I said. No, it wasn't funny. Then why don't you quit it? Now I was the one starting to feel angry. She had pushed me away and clapped her knees shut, had told me she was going away just when I was starting to not only want her around, but need her around. She had left me with what was soon going to be a world-class case of blue balls, and now it was all about me. Now it was all about cards. I don't know why I don't quit it, I said. Why don't you find someone else to take care of your mother? Why doesn't this friend of hers, Rionda, take care of her? I mean, is it your fault your mother's a lush? My mother is not a lush. Don't you call her that. Well, she's sure something if you're going to drop out of college on her account. If it's that serious, Carol, it's sure something. Rionda has a job and a mother of her own to worry about, Carol said. The anger had gone out of her. She sounded deflated, dispirited. I could remember the laughing girl who had stood beside me, watching the shreds of Goldwater bumper sticker blow away across the macadam. But this didn't seem like the same one. My mother is my mother. There's only Ian and me to take care of her, and Ian's barely making it in high school. Besides, there's always UConn. You want some information? I asked her. My voice was trembling, thickening. I'll give you some, whether you want it or not. Okay? You're breaking my heart here. That's the information. You're breaking my goddamn heart. I'm not, though, she said. Hearts are tough, Pete. Most times they don't break. Most times they only bend. Yeah, yeah, and Confucius say women who fly upside down have crack up. I began to cry. Not a lot, but they were tears, all right. Mostly, I think it was being caught so utterly unprepared. And okay, maybe I was crying for myself as well, because I was scared. I was now flunking, or in danger of flunking, all but a single subject. One of my friends was planning to push the eject button, and I couldn't seem to stop playing cards. Nothing was going the way I had expected it would once I got to college, and I was terrified. I don't want you to go, I said. I love you. Then I tried to smile. Just a little more information, okay? She looked at me with an expression I couldn't read, then cranked down her window and tossed out her cigarette. She rolled the window back up and held her arms out to me. Come here. I put out my own cigarette in the overflowing ashtray and slipped across to her side of the seat, into her arms. She kissed me, then looked into my eyes. Maybe you love me and maybe you don't. I'd never try to talk anyone out of loving me, I can tell you that much, because there's never enough loving to go around. But you're confused, Pete, about school, about hearts, about Anne-Marie, and about me, too. I started to say I wasn't, but of course I was. I can go to UConn, she said. If my mother shapes up, I will go to UConn. If that doesn't work out, I can take courses part-time at Pennington and Bridgeport, or even CED courses at night in Stratford or Harwich. I can do those things. I have the luxury of doing those things because I'm a girl. This is a good time to be a girl, believe me. Lyndon Johnson has seen to that. Carol, she put her hand gently against my mouth. If you flunk out this December, you're apt to be in the jungle next December. You need to think about that, Pete. It's one thing for Sully. He thinks it's right, and he wants to go. You don't know what you want or what you think, and you won't as long as you keep running those cards. Hey, I took the Goldwater sticker off my car, didn't I? It sounded foolish to my own ears. She said nothing. When are you going?
Tomorrow afternoon. I have a ticket on the 4 o'clock Trailways bus to New York. The Harwich stop isn't more than 3 blocks from my front door.
Are you leaving from Derry?
Yes.
Can I drive you to the depot? I could pick you up at your dorm around 3.
She considered it, then nodded, but I saw a shaded look in her eyes. It was hard to miss because those eyes were usually so wide and guileless.
That would be good, she said.
Thank you. And I didn't lie to you, did I? I told you we might be temporary.
I sighed.
Yeah.
Only this was a lot more temporary than I had been expecting.
Now, number 6. We want information.
You won't get it.
It was hard to sound as tough as Patrick McGoohan in The Prisoner when you still felt like crying, but I did my best.
Even if I ask, pretty please?
She took my hand, slipped it inside her sweater, placed it on her left breast. The part of me which had begun to swoon snapped immediately back to attention.
Well,
have you ever done it before? I mean, all the way? That's the information I want.
I hesitated. It's a question most boys find difficult, I imagine, and one most lie about. I didn't want to lie to Carol.
No, I said.
She slipped daintily out of her panties, tossed them over into the back seat, and laced her fingers together behind my neck.
I have, twice, with Sully. I don't think he was very good at it, but he'd never been to college.
You have.
My mouth felt very dry, but that must have been an illusion, because when I kissed her, our mouths were wet. They slipped all around, tongues and lips and nipping teeth. When I could talk, I said, I'll do my best to share my college education.
Put on the radio, she said, unbuckling my belt and unsnapping my jeans.
Put on the radio, Pete. I like the oldies.
So I put on the radio and I kissed her, and there was a spot, a certain spot. Her fingers guided me to it, and there was a moment when I was the same old, and then there was a new place to be. She was very warm in there, very warm and very tight. She whispered in my ear, her lips tickling against the skin,
"Slow. Eat every one of your vegetables, and maybe you'll get dessert."
Jackie Wilson sang Lonely Teardrops, and I went slow. Roy Orbison sang Only the Lonely, and I went slow. Wanda Jackson sang Let's Have a Party, and I went slow. Mighty John did an ad for Brannigan's, Derry's hottest bottle club, and I went slow.
Then she began to moan, and it wasn't her fingers on my neck, but her nails digging into it. And when she began to move her hips up against me in short, hard thrusts, I couldn't go slow. And then the Platters were on the radio. The Platters were singing Twilight Time, and she began to moan that she hadn't known, hadn't a clue. Oh, gee, oh, Pete, oh, gee, oh, Jesus, Jesus Christ, Pete. And her lips were all over my mouth and my chin and my jaw. She was frantic with kisses. I could hear the seat creaking. I could smell cigarette smoke and the pine air freshener hanging from the rearview mirror. And by then, I was moaning, too. I don't know what. The Platters were singing, "Each day I pray for evening just to be with you." And then it started to happen. The pump turns on in ecstasy. I closed my eyes. I held her with my eyes closed and went into her that way you do, shaking all over, hearing the heel of my shoe drumming against the driver's side door in a spastic tattoo, thinking that I could do this even if I was dying, even if I was dying, even if I was dying, thinking also that it was information. The pump turns on in ecstasy. The cards fall where they fall. The world never misses a beat. The queen hides. The queen is found. And it was all information.
The next morning, I had a brief meeting with my geology instructor, who told me I was edging into a grave situation.
That is not exactly new information, Number Six. I thought of telling him, but didn't. The world looked different this morning, both better and worse. When I got back to Chamberlain, I found Nate getting ready to leave for home. He had his suitcase in one hand. There was a sticker on it that said, "I climbed Mount Washington." Slung over his shoulder was a duffel full of dirty clothes. Like everything else, Nate looked different now. "Have a good Thanksgiving, Nate," I said, opening my closet and starting to yank out pants and shirts at random. "Eat lots of stuffing. You're too fucking skinny." "I will. Cranberry dressing, too. When I was at my most homesick that first week, my mom's dressing was practically all I could think about." I filled my own suitcase, thinking that I could take Carol to the bus depot in Derry and then just keep on going. If the traffic on Route 136 wasn't too heavy, I could be home before dark. Maybe even stop in Frank's Fountain for a mug of root beer before heading up Sebattis Road to the house. Suddenly being out of this place, away from Chamberlain Hall and Holyoke Commons, away from the whole damned university, was my number one priority. "You're confused, Pete," Carol had said in the car last night. "You don't know what you want or what you think, and you won't as long as you keep running those cards." Well, this was my chance to get away from the cards. It hurt to know Carol was leaving, but I'd be lying if I said that was foremost in my mind right then. At that moment, getting away from the third-floor lounge was getting away from the bitch. If you flunk out this December, you're apt to be in the jungle next December. "Be in touch, baby. See ya," as Skip Kirk usually put it. When I latched the suitcase shut and looked around, Nate was still standing in the doorway. I jumped and let out a little squeak of surprise. It was like being visited by Banquo's fucking ghost. "Hey, go on. Bug out," I said. "Time and tide wait for no man, not even one in pre-dent." Nate only stood there, looking at me. "You're going to flunk out," he said. Again I thought of how weirdly alike Nate and Carol were, almost male and female sides of the same coin. I tried to smile, but Nate didn't smile back. His face was small and white and pinched, the perfect Yankee face. You see a skinny guy who always burns instead of tanning, whose idea of dressing up includes a string tie and a liberal application of Vitalis, a guy who looks like he hasn't had a decent shit in 3 years, and that guy was most likely born and raised north of White River, New Hampshire. And on his deathbed, his last words are apt to be, "Cranberry dressing." "Nah," I said, "don't sweat it, Nady, all's cool." "You're going to flunk out," he repeated. Dull, bricky color was rising in his cheeks. "You and Skip are the best guys I know. There wasn't anybody in high school like you guys, not in my high school at least, and you're going to flunk out and it's so stupid." "I'm not going to flunk out," I said. But since last night, I had found myself accepting the idea that I could. I wasn't just edging into a grave situation. Man, I was there. "Skip either. It's under control. The world's falling down, and you two are flunking out of school over hearts, over a stupid fucking card game." Before I could say anything else, he was gone, headed back up the county for turkey and his mom's stuffing. Maybe even a through-the-pants hand job from Cindy. Hey, why not? It was Thanksgiving. I don't read my horoscope, have rarely watched The X-Files, have never called the Psychic Friends hotline, but I nevertheless believe that we all get glimpses of the future from time to time. I got one that afternoon when I pulled up in front of Franklin Hall in my brother's old station wagon. She was already gone. I went inside. The lobby, where there were usually 8 or 9 gentlemen callers sitting in the plastic chairs, looked oddly empty. A housekeeper in a blue uniform was vacuuming the industrial-strength rug. The girl behind the counter was reading a copy of McCall's and listening to the radio. Question mark in the Mysterians, as a matter of fact. Cry, 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 baby. 96 tears. "Pete Riley for Carol Gerber," I said. "Can you buzz her?" She looked up, put her magazine aside, and gave me a sweet, sympathetic look. It was the look of a doctor who has to tell you, "Gee, sorry, the tumor's inoperable. Bad luck, man. Better make friends with Jesus." Carol said she had to leave early. She took the Black Bear shuttle to Derry.
but she told me you'd be by and asked me to give you this. She handed me an envelope with my name written across the front. I thanked her and left Franklin with it in my hand. I went down the walk and stood for a moment by my car, looking across toward Holyoke Commons, fabled palace on the plains and home of the horny hot dog man. Below it, in Bennett's Run, leaves flew before the wind in rattling drifts. The bright colors had gone out of them. Only November's dark brown was left. It was the day before Thanksgiving, the doorstep of winter in New England. The world was all wind and cold sunshine. I had started crying again. I could tell by the warmth on my cheeks. 96 tears, baby. Cry, cry, cry. I got into the car, where I had lost my virginity the night before, and opened the envelope. There was a single sheet of paper inside. Brevity is the soul of wit, according to Shakespeare. If it's true, then Carol's letter was witty as hell. Dear Pete, I think we ought to let last night be our goodbye. How could we do any better? I may write to you at school, or I may not. Right now I'm so confused I just don't know. Hey, I may even change my mind and come back. But please, let me be the one to get in touch, okay? You said you loved me. If you do, let me be the one to get in touch. I will. I promise. Carol. P.S. Last night was the sweetest thing that's ever happened to me. If it gets any better than that, I don't see how people can live through it. P.P.S. Get out of that stupid card game. She said it was the sweetest thing that had ever happened to her, but she hadn't put love at the bottom of the note, only her signature. Still, if it gets any better than that, I don't see how people can live through it. I knew what she meant. I reached over and touched the side of the seat where she had lain, where we had lain together. Put on the radio, Pete. I like the oldies. I looked at my watch. I had gotten to the dorm early, that half-conscious premonition at work, maybe, and it had just gone 3 now. I could easily get to the Trailways Depot before she left for Connecticut, but I wasn't going to do it. She was right. We had said a brilliant goodbye in my old station wagon. Anything more would be a step down. At best, we would find ourselves going over the same ground. At worst, we'd splash mud over last night with an argument. We want information. Yes, and we had gotten it. God knew we had. I folded her letter, stuck it into the back pocket of my jeans, and drove home to Gates Falls. At first, my eyes kept blurring, and I had to keep wiping at them. Then I turned on the radio, and the music made things a little better. The music always does. I'm past 50 now, and the music still makes things better. It's the fabled automatic. I got back to Gates around 5:30, slowed as I drove past Frank's, then kept on going. By then, I wanted to get home a lot more than I wanted to draft hires and a gossip with Frank Parmelo. Mom's way of saying welcome home was to tell me I was too skinny, my hair was too long, and I hadn't been standing close enough to the razor. Then she sat in her rocking chair and had a little weep over the return of the prodigal son. My dad put a kiss on my cheek, hugged me with one arm, and then shuffled to the fridge for a glass of Mom's red tea, his head poking forward out of the neck of his old brown sweater like the head of a curious turtle. We, my mom and me, that is, thought he had 20% of his eyesight left, maybe a bit more. It was hard to tell because he so rarely talked. It was a bagging room accident that did for him, a terrible 2-story fall. He had scars on the left side of his face and his neck. There was a dented-in patch of skull where the hair never grew back. The accident pretty much blacked out his vision, and it did something to his mind as well. But he was not a total idiot, as I once heard some asshole down at Gendron's barbershop say, nor was he mute, as some people seemed to think. He was in a coma for 19 days. After he woke up, he became mostly silent, that much is true, and he was often terribly confused in his mind,
but sometimes he was still there, all present and accounted for. He was there enough when I came home to give me a kiss and that strong one-armed hug, his way of hugging for as long as I could remember. I loved my old man a lot, and after a semester of playing cards with Ronnie Malenfant, I had learned that talking is a wildly overrated skill. I sat with them for a while, telling them some of my college stories, not about chasing the bitch, though, then went outside. I raked fallen leaves in the twilight. The frosty air on my cheeks was like a blessing. Waved at the passing neighbors and ate three of my mom's hamburgers for supper. After, she told me she was going down to the church, where the ladies' aid was preparing Thanksgiving meals for shut-ins. She didn't think I'd want to spend my first evening home with a bunch of old hens, but I was welcome to attend the Cluckfest if I wanted. I thanked her and said I thought I'd give Anne-Marie a call instead. "Now, why doesn't that surprise me?" she said, and went out. I heard the car start, and then, with no great joy, I dragged myself to the telephone and called Anne-Marie Susie. An hour later, she drove over in her father's pickup, smiling, her hair down on her shoulders, mouth radiant with lipstick. The smile didn't last long, as I guess you can probably figure out for yourself, and 15 minutes after she came in, Anne-Marie was out of the house and out of my life. "Be in touch, baby. See ya." Right around the time of Woodstock, she married an insurance man from Lewiston and became Anne-Marie Jalbert. They had three kids, and they're still married. I guess that's good, isn't it? Even if it isn't, you have to admit it's pretty goddamn American. I stood at the window over the kitchen sink, watching the taillights of Mr. Susie's truck disappear down the road. I felt ashamed of myself. Christ, the way her eyes had widened, the way her smile had faded and begun to tremble. But I also felt shittily happy, disgustingly relieved, light enough to dance up the walls and across the ceiling like Fred Astaire. There were shuffling steps from behind me. I turned, and there was my dad, doing his slow turtle walk across the linoleum in his slippers. He went with one hand held out before him. The skin on it was beginning to look like a big, loose glove.
Did I just hear a young lady call a young gentleman a fucking jerk?
He asked in a mild, just passing the time voice.
Well, yeah, I shuffled my feet. I guess maybe you did.
He opened the fridge, groped, and brought out the jug of red tea. He drank it without sugar. I have taken it that same way on occasion and can tell you it tastes like almost nothing at all. My theory is that my dad always went for the red tea because it was the brightest thing in the icebox, and he always knew what it was.
Susie girl, wasn't it?
Yeah, Dad, Anne-Marie.
All them Susies have the distemper, Pete. Slammed the door, didn't she?
I was smiling. I couldn't help it. It was a wonder the glass was still in that poor old door.
I guess she did. You trade her in for a newer model up there at the college, did you?
That was a fairly complicated question. The simple answer, and maybe the truest in the end, was no, I hadn't. That was the answer I gave. He nodded, set out the biggest glass in the cabinet next to the fridge, and then looked like he was getting ready to pour the tea all over the counter and his own feet anyway. "Let me do that for you," I said. "Okay?" He made no reply, but stood back and let me pour the tea. I put the three-quarters full glass into his hands and the jug back into the fridge.
"Is it good, Dad?"
Nothing. He only stood there with the glass in both hands, the way a child holds a glass, drinking in little sips. I waited, decided he wasn't going to reply, and fetched my suitcase out of the corner. I'd thrown my textbooks in on top of my clothes, and now took them out.
"Studying on the first night of break," Dad said, startling me. I'd almost forgot he was there. "Gorry."
"Well, I'm a little behind in a couple of classes. The teachers move a lot faster than the ones in high school."
"College," he said. A long pause. "You're
in college.
It seemed almost to be a question, so I said, "That's right, Dad." He stood there a while longer, seeming to watch me as I stacked my books and notebooks. Maybe he was watching, or maybe he was just standing there. You couldn't tell, not for sure. At last he began to shuffle toward the door, neck stretched out, that defensive hand slightly raised, his other hand, the one with the glass of red tea in it, now curled against his chest. At the door he stopped. Without looking around, he said,
"You're well shut of that Susie girl. All Susies has got bad tempers. You can dress 'em up, but you can't take 'em out. You can do better."
He went out, holding his glass of tea curled to his chest. Until my brother and his wife showed up from New Gloucester, I actually did study, half caught up on my sociology and slogged through 40 pages of geology, all in 3 brain-busting hours. By the time I stopped to make coffee, I'd begun to feel faint stirrings of hope. I was behind, disastrously behind, but maybe not quite fatally behind. I felt like an outfielder who has tracked a ball back and back to the left field wall. He stands there looking up but not giving up, knowing that the ball's going to carry over, but also knowing that if he times his leap just right, he can catch it as it does. I could do that. If that was, I could stay out of the third floor lounge in the future. At 10:15, my brother, who arrives nowhere while the sun is still up, if he can help it, drove in. His wife of 8 months, glamorous in a coat with a real mink collar, was carrying a bread pudding. Dave had a bowl of butter beans. Only my brother, of all people on earth, would think of transporting butter beans across county lines for Thanksgiving purposes. "He's a good guy, Dave, my elder by 6 years, and in 1966, an accountant for a small hamburger chain with 6 shops in Maine and New Hampshire. By 1996, there were 80 shops, and my brother, along with 3 partners, owned the company. He's worth $3 million, on paper at least, and has had a triple bypass. 1 bypass for each million, I guess you could say." Hard on Dave and Katie's heels came Mom from the Ladies' Aid, dusted with flour, exhilarated from good works, and overjoyed to have both of her sons in the house. There was a lot of cheerful babble. Our dad sat in the corner listening to it without adding anything. But he was smiling, his odd, big-pupiled eyes going from Dave's face to mine and then back to Dave's. It was actually our voices his eyes were responding to, I suppose. Dave wanted to know where Anne-Marie was. I said Anne-Marie and I had decided to cool it for a while. Dave started to ask if that meant we were... Before he could finish the question, both his mother and his wife gave him those sharp little female pokes that meant, "Not now, buddy, not now." Looking at Mom's wide eyes, I guessed she would have her own questions for me later on, probably quite a few of them. Mom wanted information. Moms always do. Other than being called a fucking jerk by Anne-Marie and wondering from time to time how Carol Gerber was doing, mostly if she'd changed her mind about coming back to school and if she was sharing her Thanksgiving with old army-bound Sully John, that was a pretty great holiday. The whole family showed up at one time or another on Thursday or Friday, it seemed, wandering through the house and gnawing on turkey legs, watching football games on TV and roaring at the big plays, chopping wood for the kitchen stove. By Sunday night, Mom had enough stove lengths to heat the house all winter with just the Franklin if she'd wanted. After supper, we ate pie and played Scrabble. Most entertaining of all, Dave and Katie had a huge fight over the house they were planning to buy, and Katie hucked a Tupperware dish of leftovers at my brother. I had taken a few lumps at Dave's hands over the years, and I liked watching that plastic container of squash bounce off the side of his head. Man, that was fun. But underneath all the good stuff, the ordinary joy you feel when your whole family's there, was my fear of what was going to happen when I went back to school. I found an hour to study late Thursday night, after the fridge had been stuffed full of leftovers and everyone else had gone to bed, and 2 more hours on Friday afternoon, when there was a lull in the flow of relatives, and Dave and Katie, their differences temporarily resolved, retired for what I thought was an extremely noisy nap. I still felt I could catch up, knew it, actually, but I also knew I couldn't do it alone or with Nate. I had to buddy up with someone who understood the suicidal pull of that third-floor lounge and how the blood surged when someone started playing spades in an effort to force the bitch. Someone who understood the primitive joy of managing to sock Ronnie with La Femme Noire. It would have to be Skip, I thought. Even if Carol were to come back, she would never be able to understand in the same way. It had to be Skip and me, swimming out of deep water and in toward the shore. I thought if we stuck together, we could both pull through. Not that I cared so much about him. Admitting that feels scuzzy, but it's the truth. By Saturday of Thanksgiving break, I'd done lots of soul-searching and understood I was mostly concerned about myself, mostly looking out for number 6. If Skip wanted to use me, that was fine, because I sure wanted to use him. By noon Saturday, I'd read enough geology to know I needed help on some of the concepts, and fast. There were only 2 more big test periods in the semester, a set of prelims and then final exams. I would have to do really well on both to keep my scholarships. Dave and Katie left at around 7 on Saturday night, still bickering, but more good-naturedly, about the house they planned to buy in Pownal. I settled down at the kitchen table and started reading about out-group sanctions in my soch book. What it seemed to amount to was even nerds have to have someone to shit on, a depressing concept. At some point, I became aware I wasn't alone. I looked up and saw my mother standing there in her old pink housecoat, her face ghostly with Pond's cold cream. I wasn't surprised that I hadn't heard her. After 25 years in the same little house, she knew where all the creaks and groans were. I thought she had finally gotten around to her questions about Anne-Marie, but it turned out that my love life was the last thing on her mind. "How much trouble are you in, Peter?" she asked. I thought of about 100 different answers and then settled for the truth. "I don't really know." "Is it any one thing in particular?" This time I didn't tell the truth, and looking back on it, I realized how telling that lie was. Some part of me, alien to my best interests but very powerful, still reserved the right to frog march me to the cliff and over the edge. "Yeah, Mom, the third floor lounge is the problem. Cards are the problem. Just a few hands is what I tell myself every time, and when I look up at the clock, it's 12:15 and I'm too tired to study. Hell, too wired to study. Other than play hearts, all I've really managed to do this fall is lose my virginity." If I could have said at least the first part of that, I think it would have been like guessing Rumpelstiltskin's name and then speaking it out loud. But I didn't say any of it. I told her it was just the pace of college. I had to redefine what studying meant, learn some new habits. But I could do it. I was sure I could. She stood there a moment longer, her arms crossed and her hands deep in her housecoat sleeves. She looked sort of like a Chinese mandarin when she stood that way. And then she said, "I'll always love you, Pete. Your father, too. He doesn't say it, but he feels it. We both do. You know that." "Yeah," I said, "I know that." I got up and hugged her. Pancreatic cancer was what got her. That one's quick, at least, but it wasn't quick enough. I guess none of them are when it's someone you love. "But you have to work hard at your studies. Boys who don't work hard at them have been dying." She smiled. There wasn't much humor in it. "Probably you knew that." I heard a rumor. "You're still growing," she said, tilting her head up. "I don't think so." "Yes, at least an inch since summer. And your hair. Why don't you cut your hair?" "I like it the way it is. It's as long as a girl's. Take my advice, Pete. Cut your hair. Look decent. You're not one of those Rolling Stones or Herman's Hermit, after all." I burst out laughing. I couldn't help it. "I'll think about it, Mom. Okay?" You do that. She gave me another hard hug, then let me go. She looked tired, but I thought she also looked rather beautiful. "They're killing boys across the sea," she said. "At first, I thought there was a good reason for it. But your father says it's crazy, and I'm not so sure he isn't right. You study hard. If you need a little extra for books, or a tutor, we'll scrape it up."
"Thanks, Mom. You're a peach."
"Nope," she said. "Just an old mare with tired feet. I'm going to bed."
I studied another hour. Then all the words started to double and triple in front of my eyes. I went to bed myself, but couldn't sleep. Every time I started to drift, I saw myself picking up a heart's hand and beginning to arrange it in suits. Finally, I let my eyes roll open and just stared up at the ceiling. "Boys who don't work hard at their studies have been dying," my mother had said. And Carol telling me this was a good time to be a girl, Lyndon Johnson had seen to that.
"We chasing the bitch.
Pass left or right.
Jesus Christ, fucking Riley shooting the moon."
Voices in my head. Voices seeming to seep out of the very air. Quitting the game was the only sane solution to my problems, but even with the third floor lounge 130 miles north of where I was lying, it had a hold on me, one which had little to do with sanity or rationality. I'd amassed 12 points in the Uber tourney. Only Ronnie, with 15, was now ahead of me. I didn't see how I could give those 12 points up, just walk away and leave that windbag Malenfant with a clear field. Carol had helped me keep Ronnie in some sort of perspective, allowed me to see him for the creepy, small-minded, bad-complexioned gnome that he was. Now that she was gone... "Ronnie's also going to be gone before long," the voice of reason interposed. "If he lasts to the end of the semester, it'll be a blue-eyed miracle. You know that." True. And in the meantime, Ronnie had nothing else but hearts, did he? He was clumsy, pot-bellied, and thin-armed, an old man waiting to happen. He wore a chip on his shoulder to at least partially hide his massive feelings of inferiority. His boasting about girls was ludicrous. Also, he wasn't really smart, like some of the kids currently in danger of flunking out, Skip Kirk, for instance. Hearts and empty brag were the only things Ronnie was good at, so far as I'd been able to tell, so why not just stand back and let him run the cards and run his mouth while he still could? Because I didn't want to, that was why. Because I wanted to wipe the smirk off his hollow, pimply face and silence his grating blare of a laugh. It was mean, but it was true. I liked Ronnie best when he was sulking, when he was glowering at me with his greasy hair tumbled down over his forehead and his lower lip pushed out. Also, there was the game itself. I loved playing. I couldn't even stop thinking about it here, in my childhood bed. So how was I supposed to stay away from the lounge when I got back? How was I supposed to ignore Mark St. Pierre yelling at me to hurry up? There was a seat empty. Everyone stood at zero on the score pad, and the game was about to commence. Christ! I was still awake when the cuckoo clock in the parlor below me sang 2 o'clock. I got up, threw on my old tartan robe over my skivvies, and went downstairs. I got myself a glass of milk and sat at the kitchen table to drink it. There were no lights on except for the fluorescent bar over the stove, no sounds except for the sough of the furnace through the floor grates and my father's soft snores from the back bedroom. I felt a little nutso, as if the combination of turkey and cramming had set off a minor earthquake in my head. And I felt as if I might next fall asleep around, oh, say, St. Patrick's Day. I happened to glance into the entry. There, hung on one of the hooks above the wood box, was my high school jacket, the one with the big white GF entwined on the breast. Nothing else but the initials. I hadn't been much of a jock. When Skip asked me, shortly after we met at the university, if I'd lettered in anything, I told him I had the big M for masturbation, first team, the short overhand stroke, my specialty. Skip had laughed until he cried, and maybe that was when we'd started being friends. Actually, I guess I could have gotten a D for debate or dramatics, but they don't give letters in those things, do they?
not then and not now. High school seemed far in the past to me on that night, almost in another planetary system. But there was the jacket, a birthday present from my folks the year I turned 16. I crossed to the entry and took it off the hook. I put it up to my face and smelled it and thought of Period 5 study hall with Mr. Mazensik, the bitter aroma of pencil shavings, the girls whispering and giggling under their breath, faint shouts from outside as the phys ed kids played what the jocks called remedial volleyball. I saw that the place where the jacket had hung on the hook continued to stick up in a kind of dimple. The damned thing probably hadn't been worn, even by my mother, to go out and grab the mail in her nightgown since the previous April or May. I thought of seeing Carol frozen in newsprint dots, her face shadowed by a sign reading, U.S. out of Vietnam now, her ponytail lying against the collar of her own high school jacket. And I had an idea. Our telephone, a Bakelite dinosaur with a rotary dial, was on a table in the front hall. In the drawer beneath it was the Gates Falls phone book, my mom's address book, and a litter of writing implements. One was a black laundry marker. I took it back to the kitchen table and sat down again. I spread my high school jacket over my knees, then used the marker to make a large sparrow track on the back. As I worked, I felt the nervous tension draining out of my muscles. It occurred to me that I could award myself my own letter if I wanted, and that was sort of what I was doing. When I was done, I held the jacket up and took a look. In the faint white light of the fluorescent bar, the peace sign I'd drawn looked harsh and declamatory and somehow childish. But I liked it. I liked that motherfucker. I wasn't sure what I thought about the war even then, but I liked that sparrow track quite a lot. And I felt as if I could finally go to sleep. Drawing it had done that much for me anyway. I rinsed out my milk glass and went upstairs with my jacket under my arm. I stuck it in the closet and then lay down. I thought of Carol putting my hand inside her sweater and the taste of her breath in my mouth. I thought of how we had been only ourselves behind the fogged up windows of my old station wagon, maybe our best selves. And I thought of how we had laughed as we stood watching the tatters of my Goldwater sticker blow away across the steam plant parking lot. I was thinking about that when I fell asleep. I took my modified high school jacket back to school on Sunday, packed into my suitcase. Despite her freshly voiced doubts about Mr. Johnson's and Mr. McNamara's war, my mom would have had lots of questions about the sparrow track. And I didn't have answers to give, not yet. I felt equipped to wear the jacket, though, and I did. I spilled beer and cigarette ashes on it, puked on it, bled on it, got tear gassed in Chicago while wearing it and screaming, "The whole world is watching," at the top of my lungs. Girls cried on the entwined GF on the left breast. By my senior year, those letters were dingy gray instead of white. And one girl lay on it while we made love. We did it with no protection, so probably there's a trace of semen on the quilted lining, too. By the time I packed up and left LSD Acres in 1970, the peace sign I drew on the back in my mother's kitchen was only a shadow, but the shadow remained. Others might not see it, but I always knew what it was. Came back to school on the Sunday after Thanksgiving in this order. Skip at 5, he lived in Dexter, the closest of the three of us, me at 7, Nate at around 9. I called Franklin Hall even before I unpacked my suitcase. No, the girl on the desk said, Carol Gerber wasn't back. She was plainly reluctant to say more, but I badgered her. There were two pink left school cards on the desk, she said. One of them had Carol's name and room number on it. I thanked her and hung up. I stood there a minute, fogging up the booth with my cigarette smoke, then turned around. Across the hall, I could see Skip sitting at one of the card tables, just picking up a spilled trick. I sometimes wonder if things might have been different if Carol had come back, or even if I'd beaten Skip back, had a chance to get to him before the third floor lounge got to him. I didn't, though. I stood there in the phone booth, smoking a Pall Mall and feeling sorry for myself. Then, from across the way, someone screamed, "Oh, shit, no, I don't fucking believe it!" To which Ronnie Malenfant, from where I stood in the phone booth, he was out of my view, but his voice was as unmistakable as the sound of a saw ripping through a knot in a pine branch, hollered gleefully back, "Whoa, look at this! Randy Eccles takes the first bitch of the post-Thanksgiving era!" "Don't go in there," I told myself. "You are absolutely fucked if you do, fucked once and for all." But of course I did. The tables were all taken, but there were three other guys, Billy Marchant, Tony DeLuca, and Hugh Brennan, standing around. We could snag a corner if we so chose. Skip looked up from his hand and shot me a high five in the smoky air. "Welcome back to the loony bin, Pete." "Hey," Ronnie said, looking around. "Look who's here, the only asshole in the place who can almost play the game. Where you been, Chuckles?" "Lewiston," I said, "fucking your grandmother." Ronnie cackled, his pimply cheeks turning red. Skip was looking at me seriously, and maybe there was something in his eyes. I can't say for sure. Time goes by, Atlantis sinks deeper and deeper into the ocean, and you have a tendency to romanticize, to mythologize. Maybe I saw that he had given up, that he intended to stay here and play cards and then go on to whatever was next. Maybe he was giving me permission to go in my own direction. But I was 18, and more like Nate in many ways than I like to admit. I had also never had a friend like Skip. Skip was fearless. Skip said fuck every other word. When Skip was eating at the palace, the girls couldn't keep their eyes off him. He was the kind of babe magnet Ronnie could only be in his dampest dreams. But Skip also had something adrift inside him, something like a bit of bone which may, after years of harmless wandering, pierce the heart or clog the brain. He knew it, too. Even then, with high school still sticking all over him like afterbirth, even then when he still thought he'd somehow wind up teaching school and coaching baseball, he knew it. And I loved him. The look of him, the smile of him, the walk and talk of him. I loved him, and I would not leave him. "So," I said to Billy, Tony, and Hugh, "you guys want a lesson?"
"Nickel a point," Hugh said, laughing like a loon. Shit, he was a loon. "Let's go. Wheel him and deal him."
Pretty soon, we were in the corner, all four of us smoking furiously and the cards flying. I remembered the desperate cramming I'd done over the holiday weekend, remembered my mother saying that boys who didn't work hard in school were dying these days. I remembered those things, but they seemed as distant as making love to Carol in my car while the platter sang Twilight Time. I looked up once and saw Stoke Jones in the doorway, leaning on his crutches and looking at us with his usual distant contempt. His black hair was thicker than ever, the corkscrews crazier over his ears and heavier against the collar of his sweatshirt. He sniffed steadily, his nose dripped and his eyes were running, but otherwise he didn't seem any sicker than before the break. "Stoke," I said, "how are you doing?" "Oh, well, who knows," he said, "better than you, maybe." "Come on in, Rip Rip, drag up a milking stool," Ronnie said, "we'll teach you the game." "You know nothing. I want to learn," Stoke said, and went thumping away. We listened to his receding crutches and a brief coughing fit. "That crippled-up queer loves me," Ronnie said. "He just can't show it." "I'll show you something if you don't deal some fucking cards," Skip said. "I'm very, very scared," Ronnie said in an Elmer Fudd voice, which only he found amusing. He laid his head on Mark St. Pierre's arm to show how terrified he was. Mark lifted the arm, hard. "The fuck off me. This is a new shirt, Malenfant. I don't want your pimple pus all over it." Before Ronnie's face lit with amusement and he cawed with laughter, I saw a moment of desperate hurt there. It left me unmoved. Ronnie's problems might be genuine, but they didn't make him any easier to like. To me, he was just a blowhard who could play cards. "Come on," I said to Billy March, "and hurry up and deal. I want to get some studying done later." But of course there was no studying done by any of us that night. Instead of burning out over the holiday, the fever was stronger and hotter than ever. I went down the hall around 10:15 to get a fresh pack of smokes and knew Nate was back while I was still 6 doors away. "Love Grows, Where My Rosemary Goes" was coming from the room Nick Prouty shared with Barry Margot, but from farther down I could hear Phil Oakes singing "The Draft Dodger Rag." Nate was deep in his closet, hanging up his clothes. Not only was he the only person I knew in college who wore pajamas, he was the only one who ever used the hangers. The only thing I myself had hung up was my high school jacket. Now I took it out and began to rummage in the pockets for my cigarettes. "Hey, Nate, how you doing? Get enough of that cranberry dressing to hold you?" "I'm..." he began, then saw what was on the back of my jacket and burst out laughing. "What?" I asked. "Is it that funny?" "In a way," he said, and leaned deeper into his closet. "Look." He reappeared with an old navy pea coat in his hands. He turned it around so I could see the back. On it, much neater than my freehand work, was the sparrow track. Nate had rendered his in bright silver duct tape. This time we both laughed. "Ike and Mike, they think alike," I said. "Nonsense. Great minds run in the same channel." "Is that what it is?" "Well, what I like to think, anyway. Does this mean you've changed your mind about the war, Pete?" "What mind?" I asked. Andy White and Ashley Rice never came back to college at all. 8 down now. For the rest of us, there was an obvious change for the worse in the 3 days before that winter's first storm. Obvious that was to anyone else. If you were inside the thing, burning with the fever, it all seemed just a step or two north of normal. Before Thanksgiving break, the card quartets in the lounge had a tendency to break up and reform during the school week. Sometimes they died out altogether for a while as kids went off to classes. Now the groups became almost static, the only changes occurring when someone staggered off to bed or table hopped to escape Ronnie's skills and constant abrasive chatter. This settling occurred because most of the third-floor players hadn't returned to continue furthering their educations. Barry, Nick, Mark, Harvey, and I don't know how many others had pretty much given up on the education part. They had returned in order to resume the quest for totally valueless match points. Many of the boys on Chamberlain 3 were in fact now majoring in hearts. Skip Kirk and I, sad to say, were among them. I made a couple of classes on Monday, then said fuck it and cut the rest. I cut everything on Tuesday, played hearts in my dreams on Tuesday night. In one fragment, I remember dropping the bitch and seeing that her face was Carol's. Then spent all day Wednesday playing it for real. Geology, sociology, history, all concepts without meaning. In Vietnam, a fleet of B-52s hit a Viet Cong staging area outside Dong Ha. They also managed to hit a company of U.S. Marines, killing 12 and wounding 40. Whoops, shit. And the forecast for Thursday was heavy snow turning to rain and freezing rain in the afternoon. Very few of us took note of this. Certainly, I had no reason to think that storm would change the course of my life. I went to bed at midnight on Wednesday and slept heavily. If I had dreams of hearts or Carol Gerber, I don't remember them. When I woke up at 8 o'clock on Thursday morning, it was snowing so heavily I could barely see the lights of Franklin Hall across the way. I showered, then padded down the hall to see if the game had started yet. There was one table going. Lenny Doria, Randy Eccles, Billy Marchant, and Skip. They looked pale and stubbly and tired, as if they had been there all night. Probably had been. I leaned in the doorway, watching the game. Outside in the snow, something quite a bit more interesting than cards was going on, but none of us knew it until later.